Light skin, with chinky eyes, with a hair in a wrap, with colorful hairpins, slim body, nice curves in the right places. Thalia was at least 6 years older, and had a man, but I was a fly little nigga, who was already taking other niggas' women. I was dead set on getting with her. Keisha went out one night and left having me with the apartment. After a few hours, Thalia and one of her girlfriends came over. A big Andre the Giant looking creature with a slight Billy D mustache. Thalia sat at the dinette table with me and got right down to business. "I heard you wanted to see me," she said. I was shocked. She told me that she had a man, then grabbed her girlfriend and went into the bedroom to tell her something. "Yo, she on you, kid," Hav said. "I bet you can hit that right now. If I were you, I'd take in the bedroom when they come back out. Yo, what's up with her friend, though? She kind of whack, right?" I laughed in agreement as the girls came back out. Thalia and I went into the bedroom and started kissing, closed the door, and took off our clothes. She handed me a condom and started riding me. A big brick cell phone rang. It was her man. She started arguing with him as I sucked her nipples and piped her at the same time. She's actually talking to her man while she having sex with me, I thought. She hung up on him and we kept doing us. Thalia was a stone cold freak. A few minutes later, Thalia's phone rang again. Her man must have told her he was outside, cause she hopped up off of me and looked out the window, saying, "Oh shit." Her man was standing in front of his Cherokee Jeep, a heavy set older dude with an afro blowout. Thalia got some more young dick, then quickly got dressed as I kissed and sucked on her neck before she bounced. From the window, I watched the girls get into the Jeep with the dude and pull off. I asked Hav if he hit the big girl and he said, yeah, he took one for the team. That experience ruined my image of women. Females are grimy, but that shit made me like Thalia even more. After like 6 months of living with Keisha, we overstayed our welcome and she stopped managing us. But our hoorah in Harlem was a good time, especially Thalia. Havoc was tired of traveling to my crib in Long Island to record, so we agreed to move the equipment to his mom's crib in Queensbridge. 1993 in Queensbridge was a memorable year. Nas made everybody proud to be from QB, not to mention the Juice Crew legacy, the generation of rappers that came before us in the early 80s when I was still in Reef Day Camp. MC Shan, Hoogee Rap, Biz Markie, Tragedy, Craig G, Master Ace, Big Daddy Kane, Roxanne Shanté, and super producer Marley Marl, who lived in the building right next to Hav. One day, Havoc brought me to the hood photographer, Dark Brother, aka Riley's crib. A small QB apartment in the same building as the twins annoyed, right next to Hav building. This dude had pictures of everything and anything that ever set foot inside of QB. It was like the Queensbridge Museum of History, with old pictures and frames of the Juice Crew members chilling on the block, like us, before we were famous. Old pictures of Havoc and Nas, a shot of Biz Markie, Big Daddy Kane, and Coogee Rap standing in the middle of one of the blocks. It blew my mind when I found out Marley Marl produced My Melody by Eric B. and Rakim. He produced the entire Paid in Full album. Wow, I was impressed. It gave me an understanding of how serious that hood was when it came to rap music history. We made a bunch of new songs that were on fire. We'd make the beats at Hav Mom's crib, then go to a new studio in downtown Brooklyn at Hoyt and Schemerhorn to record. One of Hav's older hustler homies from QB named Star paid for our sessions. Star was cool as hell. He was making so much dough that he didn't want anything in return. He just wanted to see us succeed. From the studio, we'd rush back to the hood to let everybody on the block hear our new songs. That was how we tested all our music. If the hood loved it, then the world would love it. That was our motto. That spring, we threw a big barbecue for Havoc's birthday, right on his block. One of his boys from 12th Street named Trev shared the same birthday, May 21st, along with soon-to-be rap star from Brooklyn, Biggie Smalls. It was the first time we threw our own party in QB. We did it up with free food, alcohol, for whoever came through. We started shopping our new demo around. Uptown MCA was one of the first labels we tried. We met with an A&R named Puffy. Derek from school knew him from back in the day and set up the meeting. Puff loved our music. In Puff's office, he and Derek were playing around and got into a wrestling match. Derek scooped Puff up by his legs and slammed him on the desk hard, knocking stuff all over the place. Bad Boy was just starting, and Puff didn't even have any artists yet. He wanted Mobb Deep to be the first to come out on his new label. Puff had a little fame from working with Uptown MCA artists Heavy D and Finesse Sequence, a female rap duo known for their song Soul Sisters and for wearing green and yellow MCM suits. He introduced us to Andre Harrell, who was in charge of MCA's black music department. They wanted to sign us right then and there. We told him we'd think about it. Puff, who was a party promoter, invited us to a party he was throwing that night at a club called The Building on 24th Street and 6th Avenue in Manhattan. Of course we agreed. We went back to the hood, gathered up the boys, got some liquor and some mess tabs, and celebrated the offer and our new friendship with Puff. At the club, the bouncer at the front door wouldn't let us in because we looked so young. We told him we were on the list and to go get Puff. Finally, Puff came and let us in. Leaders of the new school were on stage performing when we walked in. The most hyper one of the group, Busta Rhymes, had a box of promotional cassettes he was tossing into the crowd. When he tossed the last cassette, he flung the empty box into the crowd and hit me dead in my forehead. I was pissed, but more embarrassed than anything. After the show, we went backstage and I stepped to Busta. "Yo, you hit me with that fucking box, yo." I barked at him. Busta's real tall, about 6'3". So he looked down at me and said, "My bad, shorty. It was a mistake." I can't front. I was kind of starstruck. So I let it slide with a handshake. We proceeded to get drunk and high at the bar. Within an hour, a fight broke out between his crew, the Young Guns, from Mount Vernon, and some other guys. Puff was visibly upset they'd broken up his party, screaming and yelling from behind a few bodyguards who had guns out. We left and went back home. Around September 1993, we brought a copy of our demo to Matty C at The Source. He called a few days before and told us he'd gotten an A&R job at this new company, Loud Records, and the president, Steve Rifkin, wanted to meet with us. Matty said he'd set up a meeting and give us a call. That weekend, Havoc wanted to chill at my grandmother's house in Long Island because he had a girl coming over and there wasn't no room in his mom crib to get busy with girls. "She has a friend for you too," he said. "Cool, you know I'm with that," I said. So we went to Long Island. It seemed like yesterday. It was a sunny Saturday afternoon. We had the crib all to ourselves because my grandmom's was at the dance school. Hav's girl, Shauna, rang the bell. I was upstairs fixing up my room just in case I was getting some. Hav brought the girls to the basement and was playing records when I came down. "P, this is Kiki," Hav said, introducing me to Shauna's friend. "Kiki, that's P." Shorty was real good looking, with chinky eyes and sexy lips. I kicked it with her in the basement, then invited her upstairs so we can be alone. After talking in my room for a while, we ordered some Chinese food. The girls wanted to go to the movies, but Hav and I had different plans. After we ate, it was right back to business. Kiki and I got busy in my room. Kiki was just my type of girl because she wasn't acting all prissy and scared. Kiki was pretty and didn't front with the pool nanny. Who wants to be turned down when you're trying to get some? I was feeling Kiki. We talked for a few hours after that. She told me how she was from Brooklyn, but was living in Ridgewood, Queens. I could see myself with Kiki, I thought. She's cute, with the perfect body, and a tough attitude. My dream girl. Back in Queensbridge, this new rapper named Biggie Smalls started making a lot of noise with his song, Party and Bullshit. I was a terror since the public school era. Bathroom passes, cutting classes, squeezing asses. Smoking blunts was a daily routine. The Scarface twin constantly played it on his boombox out on the block. Puff signed Biggie soon after offering us that deal. Queensbridge was tremendous. Almost everybody was a drug dealer. The twins, Noid, Tripp, Gotti, the whole hood. Niggas would be outside 24/7 selling crack like it was a candy store, making thousands a day. On Fridays, the top dealers would take everybody from the crew shopping. There were almost 20 of us in the 12th Street crew. They accepted me into their crew like a brother, even though I didn't sell drugs with them and wasn't from QB. Treated me like I was one of them. They spent thousands on everybody. 20 pairs of Timberlands, 20 Champion hoodies, 20 Army jackets, 20 pants, 20 everything. If one person got, we all had. But later in life, I realized they weren't doing it because they had good hearts. It was because they weren't properly paying their dealers. So they'd take them all shopping to keep them quiet. The same way a pimp does his hoes. Keep them looking good, pretty and all that. No dough. We went shopping on Steinway Street in Astoria and clubbing at night. Mostly Puffy's parties. At the building and the red zone because we can get in with no problem. We also hit the Muse, Home Base, 20 West, Club 2000, the Fever, and our favorite, the Palladium. A lot of fights, cutting faces open with razors, breaking champagne bottles over heads, gunshots, and drunken memories. We were becoming immune to the violence and danger. After Havoc's brother TJ got heavy into the drug game, he started busting his gun a lot. We gave him the nickname Killer Black. He would shoot people in a heartbeat. We couldn't bring Killer to industry functions because he might murder somebody if they looked at us wrong. I started buying bigger guns and keeping them on me at all times. Around 3 o'clock one afternoon during the school week, Dirty Harry from Hempstead, Killer and I, we're walking from the Coliseum Mall on Jamaica Avenue to my car. A gang of like 40 high school kids came down the sidewalk looking to start trouble. Killer Black walked straight through the dudes, bumping hard into whoever was in his way. I knew Killer was going to do that before he even did it. So I rushed ahead to my Acura and popped the hood open and get my Mac 11 out the engine. As I popped the hood, I looked to my left and saw the police posted up in a squad car on the corner. Turning back toward Killer, I saw the pack of dudes surrounding him, about to start swinging punches. I ran over, cocked around inside the chamber of the Mac, and screamed, "Hey yo, what the fuck is up?" Everybody ran except for one kid, who dropped his backpack and stood frozen, scared to move. Killer laughed, picked up the kid's backpack, and threw it in his face. "Get the fuck out of here!" Killer yelled, and the kid ran. After that incident, Killer told that story to everybody in the projects, so I was looking good in the streets. At least niggas knew I was ready to bust my gun anywhere, even in front of the police. Killer started selling drugs with his crew on Nas' side of the projects. The head guy over there was this dude named Little Lord, a 16-year-old crack kingpin. Killer was also his gunman. Little Lord wanted to buy my Acura, so he took me to his grandmother's crib in Ravenswood. It's a crazy coincidence how all our grandmother's cribs is in Ravenswood. And he showed me his money stash. Little Lord had like $200,000 stacked in shoeboxes in a closet. I was impressed. He offered me $10,000 to buy my act. But I wasn't ready to sell it yet. A few days later, my car was stolen down the block from my crib in Hempstead. Now right away, you're probably thinking that little Lord stole it. But he didn't even know where I lived or parked my car. I called the precinct and they found my car stripped down to the bone in Ozone Park, Queens. Damn, I should have sold it to Little Lord for that $10K. What made it even worse was that I had my Mac 11 in the engine and didn't know if the police found it or not. When I went to get the car, I took Killer and Little Lord with me. We were all nervous, wondering if they would arrest me for the gun, but nothing happened. When I saw my car, I could have cried, man. They took my white seats with the green piping, $5,000. My rims, $1,500. My steering wheel, $1,000. My passenger side airbag, $700. Dirty bastards even took my trunk lid, $1,200. $9,400 worth of shit. I popped the hood to see if my Mac was still there. Yes. At least they didn't get the burner. Lil Lord gave me $2,000 cash and towed the car to his crib. I was just happy to get my Mac back. Soon after I sold the Acura skeleton to Lil Lord, Havoc's little cousin from Crown Heights, Brooklyn, Ferg, moved to Queensbridge with us for a little while. Ferg was about 14 or 15. A cool little motherfucker. Crazy, but he was cool. He was laying low in QB because he'd been sticking up and shooting up too many people around his way. While Hav was in the crib working on beats, Ferg and I chilled outside on the block. If I was ever broke, Gotti or Tripp from the 12th Street crew were always outside hustling. They'd give me $5 or $10 to get something to eat. I hit Gotti up a lot of times like that. One of those hungry summer days, about a week after the infamous Colin Ferguson shooting spree on the Long Island Railroad, the guy who shot all those white people dead, I took Ferg with me to my crib in Hempstead to get some more bullets for my Mac from this dude named Blot, who had everything. Blot came to my crib once trying to sell Killer and me some grenades for $40 apiece. We took the train all the way to Hempstead, and Blot wasn't anywhere to be found. We chilled for a couple of hours, and got back on the LIRR to Jamaica. I boarded the train first and sat down. When I looked up, I didn't see Ferg. 2 minutes later, he came walking onto the train, his hand inside of his shirt with two fingers poking through it like a gun. He told the passengers, "Shh, nobody fucking move. This is a stick-up. Put your wallets and your purses on the ground now." I couldn't actually hear him from where I was sitting, but seeing him with his fingers pointing through his shirt while the passengers tossing their wallets and purses on the ground, I figured it out fast. This nigga walked over to where I was sitting. "Yo, son," he said nonchalantly, laughing like it was a joke. "I told these motherfuckers it's a stick up and they believe me." One of the passengers must have told the conductor, because suddenly the police rushed the train car with guns pointed at us. "Freeze or fucking move!" I couldn't believe what this little dude just did. Not to mention that Colin Ferguson just killed all those people the week before. Ferg was charged as a minor, and they hit me with 12 counts of attempt robbery. Man, this fool had us on the front page news. Ferg went home immediately, but I was sitting in Nassau County Jail for almost a week before I was bailed out. I beat all those charges, but that was the last time I took Ferg anywhere. Before the LIRR incident, Ferg told me how he shot somebody's arms off with a shotgun and other stuff that I won't repeat. Ferg was so young and spoke so freely, I didn't believe everything he said until he got locked up a year later for cutting up a fireman with a box cutter. Ferg was sentenced to 9 years for that fireman shit, and hit with more time for wilding while inside. He should be home by the time his book drop if he calm his hot ass down. When I lost my Acura that summer and found myself locked up again, I attempted to start making smarter decisions about my spending habits and how I was moving around. I bought a $1,000 hoopty, a 1984 Toyota Celica, light blue with white seats. Killer and I named it the Little Nigger. The twins almost died laughing when I told them my car's name. Havoc bought a burgundy 1990 Toyota Camry for $4,000. Nas was riding around the hood in a gold 1995 Lexus GS, and it wasn't even 1995 yet. Nas's debut, Illmatic, had gone gold in October 1994, and he was having a party at the Melting Pot nightclub in Manhattan. The whole QB went. The party was popping for a few hours when some guy in a wheelchair started beefing with one of the QB homies. How was somebody in a wheelchair still beefing? I thought to myself. Everybody from the hood was upset because Nas's moms and baby moms Carmen was in there and shouldn't be exposed to the needless drama. So one of the QB dudes kicked the wheelchair gangster in the chest, knocked him out the wheelchair, and started brawling with his crew. People got shot, stabbed, cut, and beat down. It seemed people didn't believe what we said in our songs, or they didn't care and had a fetish for pain. It's mind-boggling. We went home and saw it on the news later. We found out that the cops ran into the Melting Pot after the gunfire and saw T, the kid those guys were trying to kill that night at the Nottington House show in Jamaica, toss the gun. Damn. Meanwhile, Little Lord, who bought my Acura, got locked up for carjacking somebody at gunpoint for their Maxima in Queensbridge while we were all at Nas's party. He was probably trying to get rims and an airbag for my stripped Acura. I heard he got 5 to 10 years for that. At least he got to be in our peer pressure video before he got knocked. After Nas's party, I started thinking about that girl Kiki who Hav hooked me up with. I kept thinking about her. I wanted to tell her how much I liked her and that we should be a serious couple. I asked Hav to get her number from his girl Shauna, and Kiki and I started being together every day. We just clicked, like we were made for each other. She'd come to QB, we'd go to the movies and dinner, or to the park to talk, kiss and stare at each other. You know, the young love shit. Kiki had just moved from Ridgewood to Corona, which was closer to QB. I knew Hav and I had some hit records on our hands, and our whole life was about to change as soon as we dropped this album. I wanted to have Kiki with me before it all went down. Kiki was fucking with some dudes on the side, but I was determined to change all that. After about a month, Kiki started sneaking me into her crib late at night. She had a walk-in closet where I slept, so her moms wouldn't catch me in the morning when she got up for work. It was better than sharing the bed with Havoc. Sometimes, I slept at the twins' crib, but they had two other brothers plus two sisters. I slept on the top bunk, and it was mad roaches on the ceiling, so I had to wrap myself up in the sheets like a mummy. Fuck that. I'd rather sleep in the closet at Kiki's crib. I would spend all day in Queensbridge and get a small bottle of Hennessy and a blunt and take the 7 train from Queens Plaza to Kiki's crib in Corona. She lived directly across the street from the Hall of Science in Flushing Meadow Park. We'd snuggle up watching TV, getting nice off the Hennessy, then we'd get busy on the couch while her moms were sleeping. Sex with her was definitely the best I ever had. We fell in love quick, but we were both still running around doing dumb shit. Women advance faster than men, so I believe she was ready to be serious and I was the one fucking up. I really loved Kiki, but I was still a young dumbass. Kiki had a younger cousin, Robbie, who came by the crib a lot to drink and smoke weed with us. He'd always sing along with the James Brown song, The Big Payback, and had us cracking up. Kiki had a 3-year-old daughter from a past relationship named Kizana. A lot of people would run away from a female with a kid, but I was willing to accept her with her child because I was feeling her a lot. Shauna and Havoc warned me to be careful with Kiki because she used to mess with this dude from Brooklyn who would still come around and see her sometimes. But I didn't care about no nigga. If it was going to be a problem, then I was well equipped to handle it. When I asked her about it, Kiki claimed that she didn't mess with the kid anymore. But I didn't know what was true or false because we were still learning about each other. I was more than willing to find out, though. Kiki's favorite music was Jodeci, an R&B group that Puffy had just signed to Uptown MCA. She also loved Teddy Riley's group, Guy, but her all-time favorite was Prince. I mean, this girl was in love with Prince and Purple Rain. One thing I learned about Kiki right away was that she had a passion for music and poetry. She told me she dreamed of being a singer or songwriter someday, so she understood my passion for rap. The number one thing I loved about her, besides her inner and outer beauty, was how she never harassed or interrogated me while I spent long hours in the studio. I would see other dudes' girlfriends paging and calling them nonstop while we were trying to work. But Kiki encouraged me to work harder and gave me my space. She got major points for that. Chapter 5. The infamous. Life is a gamble, we scramble for money. I might crack a smile, but ain't a damn thing funny. I'm caught up in the dirt where your hands get muddy. Plus the outcome turns out to be lovely. Eye for an eye, your beef is mine. Matty C called to set up a meeting with Loud Records. The twins, Killer, Havoc, and I went to Times Square to meet with Matty C, Scott Free, who was another A&R, and Steve Rifkin, the founder and chairman of the label. Loud Records was just four cubicles in the RCA building, representing the Alcoholics, PMD, and a new group from Staten Island called Wu-Tang Clan, none of whom had any hit records at the time. Wu-Tang's single, Protect Your Neck, had just started playing on the radio. Steve had long hair like a surfer and didn't look like he knew what he was doing. He did, though. Sitting around the table, they listened to our songs in a big conference room with a good sound system. Their favorite was The Patty Shop by the weed spot uptown, plus a song called Shook Ones Part 1. These were the same songs we played for Puff and Andre Harrell, and just like them, Steve offered us a deal right then and there. After the meeting, sitting in the hallway with Scott Free and Killer, Scott asked us about QB and the lifestyle out there. I just so happened to have a Tech 9 in my pants, so I pulled it out. "This is how life is," I said. Scott's face looked shocked that I could have such a big gun on me without him knowing. Like, this little kid's got a big-ass gun in the corporate office. I wasn't showing off, he asked, and that's how we were living. A week later, we signed the Loud and started working on our second album. They gave us a $60,000 budget, $20,000 for our pockets. We decided to call the album The Infamous. Yammy from Hasblock gave us the name. He had the most infamous tattooed on his bicep in black ink. We were already Mobb Deep, but he dubbed us the infamous Mobb Deep. This was our second chance to show the world that Mobb Deep was something special. So we focused on our lyrics and production skills, bringing Q-Tip in to help us master the sound. We finished the whole album in 4 months. I started sniffing and smoking coke in 1995 during the making of The Infamous. A lot of niggas in the hood was selling and doing it, so it was easy to get. It was just a phase. Wu-Tang Clan had just gone gold, and they were pulling in a lot of money for the record company. Scott Free, who's from Staten Island, brought Wu to Loud. His dream was to have Raekwon and Ghostface collaborate with Mobb Deep. So he took us on the ferry to Staten Island. We walked from Scott's house to the Harbor Projects and chilled in Wu's hood, smoking Angel Dust blunts with Ray and Ghost and two white kids in the silver Benz. Ray and Ghost drove us back to QB and dropped us off on 10th Street in Ray's navy blue Acura Legend. Raekwon was working on Only Built for Cuban Links, and he said he wanted to work with Nas. So we hooked it up when we saw Nas the next day. A few days later,